The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On June 12th, Omar Mateen entered Pulse nightclub armed with a handgun, an assault rifle, and rounds of ammunition. Over the next 3 hours, Mateen killed 49 people and wounded more than 50, and called 911 to pledge allegiance to ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. The very next day, another attack, this time at the home of two police officers on the leafy streets of a Paris suburb, where Larossi Abala fatally stabbed one officer, then entered the home and killed the officer's colleague and partner, and held their 3-year-old son hostage. Abala filmed the attack and posted the video to Facebook, where he also declared his allegiance to the Islamic State. After a 3-hour standoff, a tactical team stormed the home, killing Abala and rescuing the child. In both cases, a question hung heavy on the minds of the public and the authorities. Could this have been stopped? New York Times foreign correspondent Rukmini Kalamaki examines the difficulty of managing terror watch lists and preventing attack in her article, How Do You Stop a Future Terrorist When the Only Evidence is a Thought? We reached her via Skype. And Rukmini Kalamaki, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me, Virginia. It's a pleasure.
So like Omar Mateen, Larossi Abala was known to French authorities. Why was he on the radar?
Larossi Abala was first arrested by authorities in 2011 when he was just 19 years old. And at that point in time, he was part of a cell of young men in the French suburbs who were attempting to go to Pakistan to wage jihad. And what's interesting is back then, the only act of violence that they could pin on the young Larossi Abala was that he had killed bunnies. He and his accomplices had gone to a forest near Paris where they had practiced beheading rabbits as practice for killing human beings. So you can see the problem. At that point in time, all you have really is an animal cruelty charge. They were actually able to pin a terrorism offense on him. They decided that he was an accomplice to this group that was attempting to send young men to Pakistan to wage violence. But he was considered the most junior member of the group, also the youngest. And so he got just a little over 2 years in jail. He's released in 2013. He's under surveillance until the end of 2015. And really just months later is when he committed the latest terror act earlier this month.
So looking back, any real indication, I mean, obviously some twisted torture of animals, but any real indication that an attack against people was imminent?
Well, the evidence that you have is basically the thoughts that he expressed, and those thoughts are expressed through speech. So they had intercepted emails from him that said, I'm hungry for blood and Allah is my witness. He expressed frustration at not being one of the young men who was chosen to go to Pakistan, and then you see his anger turning towards France and him saying that he's going to wipe away the kuffar, meaning wipe away the infidel in France. But there you're up against a society, France, which is not unlike America, where speech is protected. And so the burden for the prosecutors was to try to prove that he wasn't just a deranged young man who was speaking out, because that's, of course, the defense that his lawyer employed, but that he really was going to commit an act of terror. And they weren't able to do that in a definitive way. So he was considered enough of a threat to be locked up for 2 years, but not enough of a threat to be locked up for longer. And hence he was able to do what he did earlier this month.
We know that authorities are monitoring social media feeds and other communication between suspected terrorists. But then if speech is not something that can be prosecuted, so what gets a follow-up? When do authorities get alerted and start following somebody who says insidious things?
And that's the question. I mean, if you look at the FBI director's comments about Omar Mateen and their investigation that they did in 2013 and 2014, the FBI director says, we did not have reason to hold him then. What I've learned from looking at these people, and in addition to Mateen and in addition to LaRosie Abola, there are numerous other terror suspects who have gone on to do acts of terrorism who were being watched. Among them was the Kouachi brothers who did the Charlie Hebdo attack in January of 2015. Amedi Coulibaly, who is one of the first ISIS operatives, he took over a Jewish kosher supermarket in France and killed several people. And Abdelhamid Abaoud, who's the ringleader of the Paris attackers, as well as many of the attackers that took over the Bataclan and the Stade de France. All of these people had had dealings with the law. And one of the things that is a hypothesis that I'm exploring is that some of the most dangerous people are the people that get picked up in the very early stages of the radicalization, which seems to have been the case for Omar Mateen in Orlando. He gets picked up at a point in time when he's actually saying very confused things. He's saying that he's got relatives in Al-Qaeda. At the same time, he's talking about Hezbollah, which is a group that is at odds with Al-Qaeda. He gets picked up. He gets interrogated. If he's smart enough, he must have realized things I've said have caused the authorities to come to me. He gets picked up again in 2014, this time because of his casual acquaintance with a man who went on to become a suicide bomber that he met at a mosque in Florida. So at that point, he again realizes, you know, I have to be careful who my friends are. And these people then go underground and they become much better at hiding whatever the warning signs are and come back with vicious and brutal intent to carry out an attack like we've seen here. Mm. That was certainly the case for the Kouachi brothers who did the Charlie Hebdo attack. They were actually actively under surveillance in January of 2015 when they attacked the offices of the magazine here in France. They had been in and out of jail. They had had previous terrorism charges, and what they did to evade law enforcement is they began communicating on the telephones of their wives. Huh. They realized that this is what the law does. The first times that they were arrested, they had their email and their telephone conversations read back to them in court, so they clearly realized, I'm being watched. And they found a means of communicating through two people, their wives, who are not on the terror radar, therefore eluded authorities.
So their strategy changes when they realize that someone's after them. They become even more furtive, I guess. But you describe this situation as looking for needles in a haystack. Once you get hate speech online, authorities are alerted. But is there a sort of hierarchy to the terror watch list, you know, an acknowledgement that some individuals may pose a much more serious threat than others?
In France, this is one of the criticisms of their terror list. So they now have a database of over 10,000 names. It's called La Fiche S, which means the S list, S for security. And what officials here have explained to me is that it's not triaged according to risk. It's sort of like having a Rolodex with 10,000 names without any order to them. Obviously, people here are overwhelmed, and therefore things are slipping through the cracks. One thing we've noticed is ISIS has made very clear, the people that are inspired by them in the West, that just about the only requirement for claiming an attack in ISIS's name is to publicly pledge allegiance to the leader of ISIS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. We know that Omar Mateen did so in his Facebook timeline sometime before the attack. I don't know how soon before the attack, but that's been publicly reported now. That seems to me, if you're following hate speech, that phraseology, I have pledged allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, however it's said, that seems to me like that would be a phrase that should raise alarms because of what we know about how ISIS functions. And it's the case that Omar Mateen did so on Facebook, and so did the San Bernardino couple.
We're speaking with Rukmini Kalamaki. She's a foreign correspondent for The New York Times, where she covers Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Her article, How Do You Stop a Future Terrorist When the Only Evidence is a Thought?, examines the difficulty of managing terror watch lists and preventing attacks. Well, Rukmini, you mentioned several people who had been on the terror watch list, or La Fiche S in France. How often does that rhetoric turn to action?
Well, not very often. We've had now in Europe, just off the top of my head, around a dozen or so either ISIS-directed or ISIS-inspired attacks, and you have more than 10,000 names just in France. And that's not counting the names in Spain and in Belgium, in the UK, etc. So this is what law enforcement tells us, that they're literally drowning in intelligence. France is saying that this is the most intelligence they've had at any one time in their history, in the history of this republic. And a very very small number of them go on to carry out acts of terror. One of the lawyers who's been very involved in defending terror suspects in France, and so who knows these cases very well, he said to me, think about how many times people say, I want to kill my boss. Mm-hmm. That's practically every day in every office. Now, once in a while, some crazy person will actually go out and carry out an act of vengeance against their employer or against colleagues, as we've seen in mass shootings all over America. How do you differentiate the ones who are just talking from the ones who are going to go out and do that attack? And I think it's not an easy answer.
But once they're on the list, maybe they're under surveillance for a period of time. And as you've just mentioned, you know, they get released, they stop watching them. Is the terror watch list even an effective counterterrorism measure?
I think that officials don't have another one. We're in this new era where so many terror suspects are now back in Europe. We're in a society that very much prizes civil liberties, as it should. And just to give you a counterpoint, in France, one political party, the Republican Party, it's called Les Républicains, the party of former French President Nicolas Sarkozy, they're suggesting creating a new class of administrative detention where they could basically pick up any one of these 10,000 people and just put them behind bars for as long as possible without any sort of judicial procedure. It's been criticized as creating a Guantanamo in France. Mm-hmm. But that's the kind of discussion that is happening here. Most people consider that idea to be absurd, but it's what they're weighing in the face of the fact that we are a society that prizes free speech, you know, and prizes free expression. And oftentimes, the only evidence of what these people are going to do is speech on social media.
What is it that actually triggers the authorities to move from surveillance to actually questioning or detention of a terror suspect?
If they see anything that looks like they are taking steps towards the preparation of an act of terror, for example, I was told by a security source that in Europe right now, he wouldn't tell me which country, but in Europe right now, they're watching a young man who went and bought a large number of ball bearings. Ball bearings is one of the ingredients that is being used in the suicide belts that ISIS is making, which is made from the explosive known as TATP. Mm-hmm. So what they do is they bind this explosive into a vest, and then they put the ball bearings in the vest so that when it explodes, there's these metallic pieces that will essentially hurt people. And he was telling me that it's not illegal to buy ball bearings. It's something that one can buy at any hardware store. But they are watching this man very carefully. He's now got a tail on him. He's got 24-hour surveillance. All of his phones are tapped. And the suspicion is that he's plotting something. Those kind of things are obviously alerts that can let people know that something is about to happen. And the thing that we forget is in America as well as in Europe, yes, there have been these horrific attacks, but what gets much less attention is how many foiled plots there have been. And there have been a lot. In America, there have been, I don't have the exact number in front of me, but there have been a large number of people that have been arrested trying to go to the airport to join ISIS, and others who have been arrested in what the FBI believes were either the early or middle or even the late stages of trying to plot attacks. You know, of course, when 49 people are dead, it's hard to think about that. But there are a lot more things planned than things that succeed.
Well, Rukmini, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It's my pleasure, Virginia. I hope to be on again.
Rukmini Kalamaki, she's a foreign correspondent for The New York Times, where she covers Al-Qaeda and ISIS. There's a link to read her article, which is truly fascinating. How do you stop a future terrorist when the only evidence is a thought? Link is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2012, a pair of young men committed a number of robberies, stealing and eventually selling more than $8,000 worth of weapons and other equipment. It was not an ordinary B&E, though. These crimes were committed entirely online, inside the popular video game Diablo III. Understanding how to prosecute crimes that take place in digital worlds is complicated. For example, should theft of virtual equipment in an online game be a felony? Or should there be more leniency than there is for robberies committed in real life? Last year, we spoke with Kashmir Hill, who's senior editor at Fusion's Real Future column. That's where she wrote about how prosecutors dealt with the case. I started by asking her how these two young men were able to rob other players in the game.
So the way that they did this is one of them was in California, the other one was in Maryland. and they had met through a gaming chat platform called TeamSpeak. And the one in California named Patrick apparently hatched this plan. And the way that it would work is that he bought something called a RAT, a remote access tool. And he and his colleague in Maryland named Michael would send players in the game a link. And I said, oh, this is an image of a really rare item in the game. You should click on it. And when other players clicked on the link, they would download this RAT. And the RAT would let Patrick take over control of their computer. Mm. He would go in, he would take over their video game character and get it to start shaking so it dropped all of its goods. And then Michael would be hanging out nearby in his character form, and then he would swoop in and grab the items that had just been dropped, and so they would essentially steal them. Then Diablo, this particular video game, was kind of rare in that it had an in-game marketplace where you could buy and sell the weapons and armor and gold for the in-game currency or for real money. So according to prosecutors, they then took these weapons and armor to the marketplace, and they would sell it for real money. And according to prosecutors, they made over $8,000 this way.
How did law enforcement then get involved?
So the people who were playing Diablo started complaining to Blizzard, the entertainment company that runs this game, saying, hey, you know, something weird just happened. I dropped all of my goods, and I think I got hacked. Somebody stole my stuff. And so Blizzard went to the prosecutors.
And Blizzard is the maker of the game.
It's the maker of the game. And they said, hey, something weird is happening here. They were actually able to very easily, unlike victims of crime in the real world, Blizzard was able just to recreate the digital goods that had been stolen from these people. So they weren't really victims in that way, in that they immediately got their stolen stuff back. Mm-hmm. But prosecutors still considered this a crime, you know, a virtual theft, and were especially concerned about the use of this hacking tool, the RAT.
But there were still consequences. What happened to Michael and Patrick?
So they were identified. I'm still a little hazy on how the FBI figured out who they were. It may have been Blizzard itself because they would have IP information. But the prosecutors in LA filed charges against both of these players. And the kind of big charge that stuck was for unauthorized access to computers. So they said, oh, you know, you shouldn't have been accessing other players' computers. And then basically any crime that touches a computer server, a company's server, so in this case Blizzard's, when you do something wrong, it becomes unauthorized access. Mm-hmm. So rather than being charged with robbery or assault, which they were doing virtually, they were charged with unauthorized access. And then both of these guys ended up accepting plea deals where they have to pay back Blizzard 3 years of probation. And in one case, the guy in Maryland had to do community service.
Patrick declined to speak to you, but you did speak with Michael Stinger. Did you get a sense of, besides having a tough time having a job, whether he felt any remorse for what he did or what he thought of his punishment?
People always have complicated stories. He says that they never actually were able to sell their goods. He said that they did not, in fact, make $8,000 because Blizzard pretty quickly realized what was happening and basically shut them out of the game. So they couldn't sell the digital booty that they had accumulated. So that was interesting. But, I think he feels really scarred by this whole thing, that he thought he was just in a game. He says he didn't know that his accomplice in this was actually hacking people's computers. He thought it was just a glitch in the game and, you know, goods were falling on the ground and then he was getting to collect them. And that's what you do in these games. You're fighting with people. You're trying to get their goods. So I think for him, those lines had really blurred between what's allowed in the game world and what's okay in real life. And I think this is something that always happens. This is why people can be so mean online and mm-hmm. say horrible things to each other, because you don't think about it as real life.
So the Diablo robbery was in 2012, finally prosecuted in 2014. What do you think? You're in this field. Do you see these kinds of prosecutions becoming more common, or are we still a long ways away from really knowing how to deal with online crime?
We're spending more and more of our time online, and so more crimes are starting to be committed there. And I do see law enforcement being interested in that. Law enforcement sees crimes moving online and they're trying to follow them there. They just are, it takes them a while. So they're a few years behind. But I suspect that we will see more cases like this one that seem kind of weird and novel now. But, you know, it'll become more normal, especially, you know, video games are big business. Video game players can make a lot of money. And so it can really hurt them financially when they're swatted in the middle of a match, or when, you know, the servers are DDoSed because somebody is trying to throw a match. So I do suspect we will see more weird online crimes like this being prosecuted.
Well, I guess we'll be speaking with you again then, Kashmir.
I hope so.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Kashmir Hill, she's senior editor at Fusion's Real Future column. You can read her article about the Diablo III prosecutions at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It used to be that if you needed a sign for the street or a shop window or a billboard, you hired a sign painter. Now that work is done on computers and printed on vinyl using giant machines. And while the heyday of hand-painted signs is a faded memory, they haven't disappeared entirely. Roman Mars from the podcast 99% Invisible looked into the history of the craft and discovered a present-day sign-painting renaissance.
If you've ever wondered what squirrels were good for, besides being adorable, wonder no longer.
These are lettering quills, the brushes I was talking about, and they generally are squirrel hair.
That's Scott Thiessen from New Bohemia Signs, a world-famous hand-painted sign shop in San Francisco.
And have pretty long, very thin handle, so you can twirl them as you're painting like an O or an S.
Look at any movie made before 1983, and you'll see hand-painted signs everywhere.
You would see like a certain type of an A or a certain type of an S being repeated in all this different signage in certain neighborhoods. And that was the first time for me I realized there was actually a job that was a sign painter.
It's not as common a job these days, but sign painting is still thriving. And according to some of the voices you'll meet today, even undergoing a kind of renaissance. But let's start with a cartoonist.
Not just any cartoonist, though. One of America's original underground cartoonists, Justin Green.
My comic book, Binky Brown Meets the Holy Virgin Mary, that's my best-known work that I did as a young man. I can't seem to shake the little bastard.
I got to see Justin speak last year at this fancy academic comic book conference in Chicago, and he gave me a book of his sign painting comics.
Reporting right there is our friend Benjamin Walker.
The way Justin Green tells it is one night his wife asked him how he was going to pay the bills, and he said, "I'm a cartoonist." And she said, "I know, but how are we going to pay the bills?"
But an artist entering the sign painter's world had to tread carefully.
Because to tell you the truth, among hard-bitten sign painters, the word artist is a pejorative. Mechanic is the term they use.
Justin came up with an ingenious way to have it both ways. He threw himself into the world of sign painting.
And frantically reading technical manuals written in the 20s.
Hustling for work.
Learning on the job.
And gathering tips from the elder statesman mechanics.
Promising more than I could deliver.
And he documented all of his adventures in a comic strip he called Sign Game.
But the best thing about these strips is that Justin actually teaches us how to look at old hand-painted signs.
I literally did that. I mean, I would stand in front of these old sunburnt signs like a history detective, and I would see how good the craftsmen were. If someone was a fledgling or a drunk, you'd see lots of brushwork around the tricky parts, like an O. An O by an old-timer was done in about 4 strokes, amazingly. Although any neophyte can use 50 strokes to get in the ballpark. But at that point, you you can't make a living. So you very quickly learn how to coordinate your eye and hand.
It's mind-blowing to think about what was done by hand in comparison to, you know, how things are done now.
That's Faith Levine. She just co-directed a movie about sign painters.
And also wrote a great book.
With a guy named Sam Macon.
My name is Faith Levine.
My name's Sam Macon.
Faith and Sam interviewed a number of sign painters.
Including Justin Green.
To tell a story about a group of people who used to be in charge of how our cities looked.
Certain letter forms were ideal for a barbershop, and yet not for a restaurant.
Sometimes I think the most well-designed signs are the ones that we don't even notice, like a no parking sign or the street signs that tell us how to get where we're going. And so, you know, we got a lot of really amazing stories about people, you know, getting jobs lettering all the street signs for an entire city back in the day.
This was a standalone trade and industry that employed, you know, thousands of people that had a direct impact on or hand in, you know, defining our commercial landscape.
All of the sign painters Sam and Faith introduce us to are unique, but as a group, there's a consistency to these unique individuals. They're
characters, for lack of a better word.
Or as Justin Green puts it,
anyone in the sign field is a little bit nuts.
We got some wild stories.
Many of the sign painters use their painting skills to crisscross the country. Bob Doors says that he could just show up in a town on a Greyhound bus, sleep in a field, and be painting a sign the next day. It seems you can't be a good sign painter unless you're also a good hustler.
You got a new business that opens, you walk in and you say, hey, I'm your guy. I'm going to make people come into your shop because I'm going to paint the sign that people are going to walk by, stop, look at, and come in the door because it looks so good. And that is your hustle as a sign painter. And that's what it was, and that's what it still is.
At the heart of the sign painter hustle is a promise that whatever you have me put paint on, a wall, a sandwich board, or the side of your truck, it's going to make you and us both look good.
You know, I'm going to make sure that this truck stops traffic.
But the thing is, there was never just one guy doing the sign painter hustle. Sign painting was competitive. It was very, very hard to break into the business.
It's like you couldn't get hired if you didn't have experience, but they didn't want to hire someone with experience because they didn't want them to take all the jobs. You really had to kind of earn your stripes. We're talking about a minimum of 2 years experience to even call yourself, you know, a sign painter, and even that could be debated.
Because you need to have the necessary knowledge of how to form the letters, lay out the wording.
Certain kinds of informational signs had to be crisp and clear, and a Roman letter form would be completely inappropriate.
That knowledge needs to be just like so baked in that you can then apply it hanging off the side of a building in the winter, painting fast.
It really is an arduous training, aesthetically and physically.
In his sign game strip, Justin Green tries to help us understand why things used to be done a certain way. In one of his comics, he explains why sign painters didn't like to use the color yellow. It required double coating and faded easily.
But in every single one of Justin Green's comics, you get a sense that he is scrambling to document a world that is fading away.
I felt compelled to do the sign game as a historical piece because I knew the world around me was crumbling overnight.
Sign painting is by no means the only industry that was wiped out by digital technology. But still, I can't help but feel extra sorry for these guys because they got their butts kicked by vinyl.
Specifically the vinyl plotter, which looks kind of like a big computer printer.
The vinyl plotters are machines that would basically tap out vinyl letters. You would program in, you know, welcome, and then it would punch out the vinyl letters, and you'd weed out the vinyl with a razor blade and put the welcome letters onto the surface of your sign.
When vinyl first appeared, no one would accept it. And yet, for all intents and purposes, it was even better than a hand-painted sign because it was perfect. It was of the same color. It would weather better than paint. And for maintenance, because window washers were our enemies, it stood up to them.
The vinyl plotter was something sign painters really liked to hate, in theory.
And it was considered like selling out, undermining your brothers in the trade. But then slowly the guys who stubbornly clung to their brushes would call the guys who had the machines when they got in a jam. And they'd say, I'm just going to do it this once, you know, but could you, you know, you give me these 100 words? And then before long, everybody bought into it.
By the mid-1980s, sign painters were no longer in charge.
It's a very simple story. Technology lowers the bar to entry. You've got people that aren't necessarily the most like visual people sometimes going into like a Kinko's or a Fast Signs and saying, these are the words. And those words are printed out on a thing that could qualify as a sign, and that's what goes up.
It's like a Tower of Babel. You know, there's thousands of fonts. Fonts named after girlfriends.
But all is not lost for the sign painters. New and old businesses who want to advertise quality and craftsmanship of the items and services inside the store want a sign that embodies that quality and craftsmanship on the outside of the store. And back in San Francisco at New Bohemia Signs, Scott Thiessen says business is booming.
Seems in the past 3 or 4 years, there's been a resurgence of especially designers really appreciating hand-painted signage. You know, the way the letters flow on the brush, you can do slight things to make the lettering look a little bit better. I think just having something that's hand-done hopefully will always be appreciated. You know, it's the pendulum always swings back and forth.
And unlike the cutthroat days of the hustle, New Bohemia now teaches sign painting classes that consistently sell out.
And we don't view it as creating competition. We're viewing it as the more people see that, you know, what a hand-painted sign looks like, the more likely someone's going to want it.
Heather Hardison is one of the young painters who took up the craft a couple of years ago and is now a journeyman painter at New Bohemia.
Damon, who's the owner, always says, it's not perfect, it just looks really good. And that lends to what makes it beautiful. That little wobble is gorgeous.
And that story came to us from Roman Mars in the podcast 99% Invisible. There's a link to his podcast and to the documentary film Sign Painters at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For our latest installment of the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, I spoke with Helen Simonson, who is a delight and writes delightful books like the New York Times bestseller Major Pettigrew's Last Stand. That was her first novel, published, by the way, when she was 45. So it's never too late. She's now out with her second novel, The Summer Before the War.
Hello, I'm Helen Simonson, and this is the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
Helen, which is harder for you to write? Is it the first sentence or the last?
I would say definitely the last sentence. I'm the sort of writer that gets a small image or one line in her mind, and that's enough to set off on the marathon journey of a novel. But I don't actually know where I'm going, so I live in fear and trembling for months and indeed years, never knowing when I'm going to get to that last line, if I'm going to get to the last line.
Do you edit as you're writing along, or do you get it all out there and wait till the end?
I very much edit as I go along. It's another form of procrastination to keep going over and over the material you already have. So I'm doing that for most of a novel. And then I would say towards the end, there's a sudden fling towards the finish line. And actually, that seems to be the sort of piece of my work that requires less editing. When I actually embolden myself to hurl forward, it turns out that needs less editing than when I'm quietly ticking along, not sure where I'm going.
Aside from that little procrastination technique, what's your personal worst distraction from getting your work done?
I would have difficulty choosing between the refrigerator and home and garden television, both of which are
two
not
formidable
good for
challenges.
Me. Yes, two formidable challenges, not to be taken in large doses. Moderation in all things, people.
Are there personal habits that you would encourage other writers to take up, maybe that you've learned along the way, or even to avoid to become more productive?
Well, you should avoid my writing process in its entirety. My writing process can be summed up in one word, and that is procrastination. I write as little as possible. And I think that's about fear of the empty page. So I would encourage everyone to try any of the habits I have tried. I have tried the tomato timer technique, where you set literally a kitchen timer for 40 minutes or 20 minutes. I have told myself 2 hours a day, no matter when I start. And then sometimes at 8 o'clock at night, I will finally get down to writing. I think it's all about beating the procrastination, putting down the self-doubt, and tricking yourself to the writing table and to the computer any which way you can.
Well, somehow you manage it, though.
Yeah, somehow, it takes 5 or 6 years, somehow a novel extrudes itself from this process. Certainly with the second novel, it's occurred to me that what I see as procrastination and laziness, and about which I berate myself all the time, is actually a process. And what I'm doing much of the time is I'm thinking about and worrying away at my novel in my head. And then when I do go to my desk every week or so, every couple of weeks maybe, I've actually sort of figured out where my characters are going next, and I can move my writing along. So it'll be interesting. Third time around, I'm looking to see how much I can push my rigorousness and how often I get to the table without losing the sort of epiphanies that seem to gestate out of the procrastination.
It's interesting because you're, at least in the summer before the war, Beatrice Nash is, she's got a lot of gumption. She's got a lot of spunk. Do you kind of create the character who charges forth and does the things you don't do in your work?
Oh, very much so. You detected that hint of aspiration there. I would like to think of myself as a Beatrice Nash, and not somebody perhaps more like the poet Daniel, wallowing around in a deck chair with a handkerchief over one's face, wishing all the poems were already written. So, yes, I admire people who are diligent and rigorous, who have their work and life in place and know what to do every day, and I do aspire to that.
So what do you think is the most common mistake that new writers make?
Remembering myself, and I did this too, I have new writers come up to me all the time and they say, I'm thinking about a novel, or I just started a novel, and how do I get an agent? And I remember feeling the same way, because enthralling rush to be a writer and wanting it so much, you really almost want the writing to be over and the career to already be taking off. And I have to gently remind them that writing is a marathon, not a sprint. It took me 15 years before I wrote a novel that was published. And so one really has to take a more apprenticeship approach to it. You're going to do your little bit of writing today and your little bit of writing tomorrow, and you're going to learn your craft, and good work will find a home. I urge on people all the time to understand that it will take time, but their good work will find a home if they'll only settle down and work at it.
What, besides being far from HGTV and the refrigerator, is for you the best environment for writing?
I sort of like a clean table, and I'm sort of have mixed thoughts about sunshine. I do like sunshine on green grass, but then often I catch myself just staring at sunshine on green grass and instead of staring at the page. So perhaps a completely blank hotel room near Newark Airport would be the best writing environment for me.
How much research do you do before you start? Because you are writing historical fiction.
Well, I think I'd probably written 20 or 30 pages of The Summer Before the War before I realized that it was set in 1914 and that I was actually going to have to do some research. It was rather a shock to me. But then I sort of enjoyed meeting with research librarians and sitting in large, imposing marble libraries, scouring obscure historical documents. And that can be very seductive. You could do that your whole life and never get around to actually writing the book. So there's about 2.5 years of research a total in this book. And the most amazing thing is at some point you really have to take all that you've learned and set it aside and just write the story. And then in editing, what you're doing, what I found myself doing, was paring away historic details, because nobody wants a novel that is weighted down by, you know, all the interesting trivia I have acquired.
Do you use a pen or pencil, computer, typewriter?
I love to type on the computer. For me, it's sort of like Pac-Man. I write a sentence, and if it doesn't look right, I can go back and munch up the little words. And then there's a clean page there for me to write away again. If I get really, really blocked, sometimes I will force myself to go to a coffee shop with a new notebook and a pen and indulge in a little free writing. But I find that somewhat troublesome in that I have terrible handwriting.
How many times were you rejected before getting published?
I had many, many short stories rejected from the New Yorker all the way down to the smallest literary magazines you could imagine. And I actually loved being rejected because I would get letters in the mail and they were addressed, Dear Writer. And I would take them. I had a large spike, got that piece of advice from Stephen King, I believe, in his writing book. Take a large nail, and then when you get your rejection letters, spike them on the nail and see how large you can grow that pile. I'm afraid when it came to my novel, I sent it to the one agent that I had met several years before, and she took me on right away. So I have to say, in that sense, I won the literary lottery.
Okay, that's a good piece of advice for dealing with rejection. But how about on writing? What's the best advice you ever received about writing?
The best advice I ever received about writing, two sets of advice. One was the good work will find a home, and I attribute that to Bob Reeves, who ran the writing program at Stony Brook Southampton College, where I did my MFA. Treat everybody as a writer whose good work has not yet found its home. And the other great writing advice was from an internet friend of mine. He's a writer who writes sort of noir detective novels. His name is Timothy Hallinan. He's at timothyhallinan.com. And he has an entire guide to writing your novel. And most of his advice is along the lines of, is your bottom in the chair? Is your computer turned on? Are you actually working? If not, what are you whining about? So very concrete advice about every aspect of the novel. And his pages kept me sane through the writing of two novels.
Any other dream job besides writer?
Well, now that I've won the literary lottery, one, I'm thinking perhaps I should buy a few actual lottery tickets because being a lottery billionaire would be a good career. I also perhaps may be emboldened to take up pop singing since, in my view, becoming a published author used to seem about as likely as becoming a pop singer. So why not go for the whole Madonna?
We can't wait to speak to you after you've hit those heights.
Unfortunately, I can't sing, so that is a minor stumbling block.
Helen Simonson there, author most recently of The Summer Before the War. To hear more episodes of the 10-Minute Writers Workshop, subscribe to the podcast. There's a link on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And before we head out today, we pour one out for guitarist Scotty Moore, who died at his home in Nashville this week at age 84. While Elvis Presley swiveled his hips to stardom, the Sun Records sideman was behind him on lead guitar, defining Elvis's early style. Scotty Moore went on to play with Johnny Cash. And on the day Johnny Cash died, I was working for NPR's On Point and felt lucky to get Scotty Moore on the line as a guest. I will never forget him talking about how Johnny went downhill after his wife, June Carter Cash, died. Now, Tom, I love my wife, he told host Tom Ashbrook. You love your wife. We all love our wives. But Johnny and June, they were something special. Scotty Moore was something special, too. He was never as famous as Elvis, but his aggressive runs and country pickings changed the role of the lead guitar in pop music. Everyone wanted to be Elvis, Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards once said. I wanted to be Scotty Moore. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.
That's all right. That's all right.